This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Tom Cruise, now the man everybody loves to hate. And sometimes they do that to you, Rick.
They do. But you're not telling me that, like, I'm going to go home and Jolene's going to be off in New York with, like, the couch and the high def, are you?
I have no information about
that. Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Tom Cruise of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey. How you doing, babe?
I know that's a little unfair. Last week, we had Kathleen as the Katie Holmes of Education Policy, which really made no sense either. But I just thought I'd use that. Because, you know, Tom Cruise, now the man everybody loves to hate. And sometimes they do that to you, Rick.
They do. But you're not telling me that, like, I'm going to go home and Jolene's going to be off in New York with, like, the couch and the high def, are you?
I have no information
okay.
about that. No,
all right. I feel a little concerned there.
Yes. But, you know, I mean, we were all concerned when you took up Scientology. That was a big surprise for many of us. For somebody who doesn't even vote to throw their lot in with a group that seems so dogmatic in some ways.
Well, you know what happened was it was because I failed out of science eventually in high school.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to make it up. So I the whole STEM talk,
uh-huh.
I said, that sounds like science. I'm going to be all about Scientology.
Woo!
As an educator.
Yeah, I liked how you rolled with that.
I got a little confused.
Nice. Good. Hey, it's good to have you on the show. It has been a while.
It has. I've missed you.
I know. You are, you know, few and far between here. You write books, you give speeches, you travel, you flitter around teaching, supposedly.
Teaching, supposedly. Yeah, I was at UPenn, baby.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be at Rice next week.
Which, nice.
And while you vacay.
I can't believe you actually have to go to these places anymore. Can't you do this by Skype? I mean, hasn't technology caught up to this point?
You're the guy who keeps saying that you don't really believe it's the same as kind of that touchy Waldorf kind of model.
Uh-huh.
Same thing. When you're trying to, like, work with, you know, mid-career educators.
Right.
There's some value, I feel like, in being able to actually talk and interact with them.
No, I like it. So you can walk in your flip-flops and your shorts, and you can, you know, swear in person.
You can engage in a Socratic dialogue, baby.
Okay. All right. So we have a lot to cover. It's the summer, yet the education policy debate moves on. We're going to play part in the gadfly with Ty, and then we're going to hear Amber's research minute. So, Ty, let's get us started with part in the gadfly.
The NEA recently acknowledged that its membership had dipped by at least 100,000 in the last 2 years. Will the nation's largest teacher union retain its political influence?
Yes. I mean, look, Rick, I mean, so this is what, 3.1 members to 3.0 members? Maybe it'll go down to 2.8 million members. I mean, this is not a huge, huge difference. Even though it may have the union freaked out, they still have a lot of ability to raise political cash. We've got recent stories in the Wall Street Journal showing how much they raise and how much they spend. They spread the money around to Democratic candidates, to liberal interest groups. I mean, they may be somewhat weaker after Wisconsin and the recession, but they are still a behemoth out there.
Yeah, agreed. But I think there's three other things to keep in mind. One, political power is partly a product of reputation. And the NEA, absolutely, after being unable to take out Walker, after not only being unable to take him out, but having him win by 7, definitely looks a whole lot weaker than it did, you know, even 12 months ago. Second is there are now opponents in the Democratic Party that the teacher unions never historically had to contend with. The fact that you now got Stand and you got DFER and you got, you know, these other organizations kind of agitating suddenly means that it has much more direct challenges for members. And third, most significant, look, if you're a union leader, you're exactly right. They are still a monster when it comes to unionization, especially given collapse of private sector unionization. But union leaders look at trends. And if these guys are looking out there and things are going the wrong way and they're feeling nervous, they very well might start to make different calculations than they would when they felt invulnerable and felt like they were riding high.
All right. But what are we actually going to see them agree to that they haven't agreed to before?
What would Randy agree to in New York in 2004, right? She still got her 43% pay raise even mm-hmm. after the Moskowitz hearings.
Right.
But
and her sweetheart deal on pensions.
And the sweetheart deal on pensions. But you did see language given up with regard to you know, the first inkling of mutual consent, not mutual consent, but the ability to kind of create the ATR, which, you know, the ATR was created in the 2004 contract.
What's ATR?
Oh, the teacher reserve.
Okay.
Which begat the rubber rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've actually put that out there. So, you know, the reality is that union leaders making different decisions doesn't mean they are suddenly going to sign up for stuff that you and I might think would be good.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean they're going to be less intransigent and more open to making deals.
Topic number two.
Is sequestration a scenario ed policymakers should be concerned about? And what would it mean for schools?
I love that word, sequestration.
It sounds smart. It sounds very Washington.
It does sound Washington. Thank goodness we have so many smart people in Washington. All the surveys keep telling us. But what is this? This basically means what? That education spending is going to take a 7% hit if Congress does not do something to change the course of current policy?
Yeah, and let's, you know, and you had a fun exchange with Allison Klein from EdWeek. She wrote a column about how 3,000 groups have signed up to fight, you know, argue against sequestration. Let's keep in mind that the whole logic of sequestration was in this tiny, insignificant, sad budget deal that Congress and the president worked out last summer. They agreed that we were going to borrow $1.2 trillion less over the coming decade than we had signed up. Now, it's not like we're balancing budgets. We're still borrowing $1 trillion a year we don't have. We were just going to borrow a tiny bit less. They couldn't figure out on the super committee how to actually make those cuts. So what the Congress had said is half the money will come from defense, half will come from domestic programs. But everybody, all of the, you know, special interests lined up and said, we got to protect Social Security. We got to protect Medicare. So they said it all has to come out of domestic discretionary. And now all those groups are saying we don't want to have any of the cuts come from us.
And they say they want a balanced approach. It sounds balanced if half comes from the military, half comes from them. What they don't say is take it out of Medicare and take it out of Social Security, which, by the way, would be a really good idea.
That would be an excellent idea. I want to hear them. I'd like to hear one of these 3,000 groups actually stand up and suggest that.
I mean, look, what we don't see happening out there are these education groups making the case that young people in this country are getting screwed. And you know what? Young people in this country are getting screwed.
Big time.
Okay? And we should see groups like Education Trust, as well as these education groups, be willing to say to their allies on the left, hey, we cannot continue to afford to give retirees such generous retirements via Social Security and Medicare if we want to make investments in our young people.
While we're borrowing money that the young people are going to be stuck repaying.
But they are not ready to do that yet. Look, I'd like to go out and start the lobby, the young people's lobby.
Problem is young people don't actually have a lot of money to fund that lobby.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg does.
Mm-hmm.
Topic number three.
There's been a lot of talk among conservatives about class and education recently. Can schools actually spur social mobility?
Yeah, well, it depends what we mean by social mobility.
So what is social mobility, Mike?
Well, look, social mobility, you can look at it a couple different ways. One is whether or not people who grow up in a certain income quintile, let's say, make more money as adults than their parents did when they were the same age. So in other words, you know, is it the American dream? Are you doing better than your parents? That's one way. The other way is look at relative social mobility. People who grew up poor, do they have a decent chance of going on to grow up and be in the middle class or be rich, right? What we know is that America has less of that kind of relative social mobility than many of our industrial peers out there. And that's a cause for concern, that there's stickiness, especially at the bottom. Poor people have a really hard time climbing out of that lowest tier compared to in other countries, though recent news came out that the poor people still are doing better than their parents did a generation ago. The question for schools is a lot of us in school reform are motivated by this idea that a great education is going to be the ticket for a poor kid to get out of poverty. And we talk about it often in ways that they're not going to just get out of poverty. They're going to go, you know, to the Ivy Leagues, and they're going to enter this new elite that Charles Murray talks about that's running the world. And I think that we have to be more realistic, that it can help them climb out of poverty, and data shows that, if they get a good education, and particularly a college education. But that means going from poor to working class or middle class. It doesn't mean going in one generation from very poor to very rich. That rags to riches thing just doesn't happen very often, and we're kidding ourselves if we think that's the goal.
Mm. So isn't that an indictment of American society?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you know, it depends on what you think about the goal here. You know, should people, you know, do we have to have this idea that people are going to be able to do this rags to riches thing in one generation? I don't know if it's ever happened like that. Over the course of several generations, okay. And can we make sure that our meritocracy, in the extent that we have a meritocracy, is fair and that we give people who really are talented a chance at having a way to climb that ladder?
But you're telling me that some kids are going to be born and it's the odds of them getting rich are really slim, and other kids are going to have a much better odds of being rich.
Yep.
Isn't that an indictment of American society?
If you're socialist, yes. So, no, I know what you're talking about. Look, I think that we have to be more clear-headed about this. And one thing it means, for example, is, you know, if we're talking about kids who grew up in abject poverty, you know, the chance of getting them into Harvard is not good. Okay, a few of them, yes, and we should definitely have opportunities for these super smart kids who are in these tough situations to be identified, to be helped. I think to some degree, KIPP does this kind of thing that they don't want to admit it. All right, we should support those efforts. But what we should really be focused on is if you're growing up in abject poverty, I want to at least make sure you have a real shot at getting into the working class or the lower middle class. And that means, you know, say the charter schools of the world, the KIPPs, the Yes Preps, would they be happy if their graduates went on in 10 years from now, say their middle school graduates, 10 years later, they're working as plumbers and electricians, cops, firemen, teachers? That'd be a huge, huge accomplishment compared to what their trajectory otherwise probably would be. And yet in the school reform movement, you know, again, we sort of assume that what we're trying to do is to get those really poor kids into the academic elite, into being doctors and lawyers and et cetera. Hey, if we can do it, great, but I don't think it's going to happen at scale. And we shouldn't scoff at various vocational and technical programs that would help kids get into a place where they're going to make a good living, much better living than their parents.
Mm.
That's what I have to say about that. Mm. And that is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You know, I was going to tease you and ask you how your last week has been. You were out in Seattle, but actually, we are taping this a week ahead of time.
We are, so I'll be able to tell you how Seattle is in a couple more weeks,
right.
Just not now.
All right, good. Well, what do you have for us this week?
So this week, we've got a new Blackboard study out. So Blackboard's that ed tech company. So we need to take the results here with a little grain of salt. The survey also
What? Is that a bias against for-profit companies?
Also a convenient sample, which means the respondents are not representative in any way, which is a tad bit of a problem. But again, it's July. Pickings are a little slim. But hey, it's still some interesting stuff in here.
Okay. Yep.
There were a lot of respondents, so kudos to them. 44,000 parents, 330,000 students, 36,000 teachers. So that's not shabby, even though it's a convenient sample.
Okay.
All right, few findings. A majority of the teachers, 52%, now report participating in an online class for PD, which is a 148% increase since the survey was administered 5 years ago. So a lot more online PD for teachers.
Mm-hmm.
A majority of parents, 54%, support online learning since it provides students the ability to work at their own pace. 54% say they like it since it allows their child to review material as many times as they need to. So sort of a Khan Academy thing. 49% say online learning allows their child to take a class not offered at the school.
Mm-hmm.
But now let's look at the sort of the other end of the spectrum, which is interesting. Only 17% say it allows their child to get more individualized attention from the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And only a quarter say it increases their child's motivation and engagement with course material.
Hmm. These are parents whose kids are using online learning?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. As for the administrators, 37% of them say they're using online PD for teachers as a way to address budget issues.
Mm-hmm.
A similar percentage say online learning helps to eliminate cost associated with textbooks. 46% say it's good for remediation. But again, barely a quarter say it provides classes in hard-to-staff areas, so they're not using it that way, apparently. Mm-hmm. And barely a quarter say it provides personalized instruction to students. So anyway, I think what was striking to me about sort of these parents and administrators is they seem to have very preconceived sort of boxed-in notions about the potential of online learning and what it can and can't do and its potential.
That's interesting, though. I mean, it could be that the stuff their kids, their students are doing isn't providing much personalized instruction, right? I mean, especially if it's basically just the kid goes on and they're just interacting with the software. I mean, it doesn't, you know, a lot of these programs aren't necessarily being led by teachers or online.
I mean, I guess the remediation to me feels like worksheets, you know? I mean, because I don't know. I guess, I don't know. You don't know what programs are using, but to me, it's kind of sad that they've already said, no, it's not good for interacting with kids. You know what I mean? Are you really just taking sort of a static intervention like a worksheet as a review activity and then just sort of plopping it on a computer for kids to sort of just check off boxes? I don't know. I just feel like in many ways the potential and promise of online learning is not being realized at the district level.
But the these findings, look, we have seen in survey after survey that people are skeptical of online learning.
Right.
The public is, parents are, the reform community is much more enthusiastic about this than most people are out there. And part of the question is why? I mean, does this give us some insights into why people are not more pumped up about it?
Not really. I mean, if anything, it kind of puts a little glossier spin on it, you know. In terms of the excitement around it, and yes, there's more teachers taking online PD, and there's some findings around if you're more likely to take an online course, you're more likely to think kids should be using mobile devices and iPads in classrooms, which sort of makes sense. But again, you know, using the technology is not the same as sort of integrating the technology meaningfully in in the course content.
Look, and I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, as a parent, granted my kids are little, and so I worry about screen time as it is. I'm not super psyched about them spending a lot of time with these electronic devices that we've all become addicted to. You know, it feels like that's taken away from their childhood, and I want to protect them from that. You know, the second thing is, when I think about education now and about school, you know, the learning discrete skills and gaining discrete knowledge is a piece of it, but it's not the whole piece, and it's probably not the biggest piece, but again, particularly when kids are little, might become more important later. But you know, I want them learning how to interact with other kids and how to, you know, deal in a social circumstance, and you know, just how to be good. And I think people, you know, there's just a lot of still skepticism about what you can do sitting in front of a computer versus, you know, having to get thrown in there in a brick and mortar classroom.
But I mean, I guess I think too, some of these programs can sort of give kids the opportunity to engage around it. So just a little small example you showed me. Remember Carl, Talking Carl on your iPhone?
Yes, absolutely.
You told me your kids like that? I showed it to my godson this past weekend and his two little other four-year-olds. I mean, 3 or 4 minutes, I had like four-year-olds, you know, wanting to poke Carl and talk to Carl and hear Carl. And so in a way, I was thinking, gosh, you know, if there's a good type of technology, you know, that can actually foster kids, how they interact. And, you know, it can be sort of a jumping off point for that socialization instead of just them talking at, you know what I mean?
Yeah, if you have a standard where your standard is teach the child how to poke a cartoon character in the eye.
I'm just thinking there could be something out there that could get kids interacting with it
There's a lot of smart people trying to figure out how to harness this potential in technology. And we're still in early days. As the stuff gets better, maybe people will come along. But I think that the point is, it's always going to be just a piece of the picture. And people are going to worry about how do you get to that other stuff that we really want kids to do face-to-face in the real world. And as you know, when you make people comfortable with that, maybe they'll get more on board the online learning piece.
Yeah. Well, and it's not the computers replacing the teacher, which I think is what a lot of parents still think. You know, it's not, I don't want a box being my child's teacher.
Robots. Okay. Well, that's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.